Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, Thea. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm going to go straight into what we've got coming up on this week's show because there's quite a lot to get through. So coming up, Keep Up, Watch Out, or Why the People Next Door Have Always Mattered. The historian Arnold Hunt considers two studies of early modern neighbourly behaviour. But first, 50 years ago, more or less to the day, E.M. Forster's final novel, Morris, was published. Almost 60 years before that, Forster had written the first draft, knowing even then that this love story between two men, the well-heeled Morris and the working-class Alec, who gives him all he had lacked in his previous sexless relationship, would not be published during his lifetime. Peter Parker, the biographer of J.R. Ackerley and Christopher Isherwood, among others, and the editor of an anthology of queer life in London between 1945 and 1967, has revisited that novel for us this week and joins us now to tell us more. Peter, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
The gestation was pretty protracted, wasn't it? And crucially, as I said, he never seriously thought it would, or in a way should appear in his lifetime. So what's the story there?
Well, he started it in 1913. There's a very well-known story that he tells in a sort of afterword he wrote to the novel, in which he visited Edward Carpenter, the sort of utopian figure up in Sheffield. And while there, Carpenter's boyfriend just pinched him on the bum, basically. And he said that this went straight to his imagination, and he sort of conceived the novel then. The other interesting thing is that Carpenter was very middle class, and his lover, George Merrill, was born in the slums of Sheffield. So, in fact, there was a relationship there that had lasted for 20 years and would go on after that, that showed that it was possible to have a homosexual relationship at that period that did cut across the class divide. So he went back to Harrogate, where he was staying with his tiresome old mother, who was at the spa there, and immediately began writing it. He had some setbacks. The person who Clive is based on, H.O. Meredith, whom he'd been at Cambridge with, was thoroughly bored by the book when showed it, and that checked Forster, but he did manage to finish it by July 1914. It had a very troublesome ending. It had an epilogue. The epilogue had Morris and Alec becoming woodcutters in some sort of imaginary greenwood, and everybody thought it was ridiculous and didn't work at all. So he sort of put the whole thing on one side. Then he returned to it after he'd done war service with the Red Cross in Alexandria, and then started rewriting it again. And then he kept revisiting it right up until 1960, when he did the final version.
I suppose one of the main points is that he could have published it. I mean, this, what you're describing, isn't so much a question necessarily of him readying the work for publication as a fear as to whether the readers were ready for it as well. That kind of lies behind his decision in the end, doesn't it? I mean, other books, as you point out, about gay relationships had appeared, but he was very resistant because of a concern about how it would be received.
Yes, he was. One of the things was he said he was determined that it should be have a happy ending. The novel should have a happy ending. And that's one of the things he thought would stand in the way of publication, that, as he put it, two men can defy the world and not be punished for it. Because a lot of novels about homosexual life did. I mean, there was a whole trend of them sort of ending in suicide or disgrace or imprisonment, which, of course, happened in real life. But the idea of a happy ending was absolutely essential to him. He said, I wouldn't have bothered to write the book otherwise. And he'd also been quite closely involved with a number of other books that had been successfully prosecuted for obscenity. Which didn't necessarily mean that they were explicit, but that they had a homosexual theme or even a heterosexual theme that was deemed unpublishable. But he did prepare the book for final publication in 1960, by which time, of course, quite a few gay novels had been published, some of them indeed with happy endings. Thinking of Mary Reynolds' The Charioteer, which is one of my absolute favourites. I think it's a wonderful novel, and it's also about people who had been at Dunkirk. So it's not sort of about, as they tended to be sometimes, sort of fey window dressers, but these were sort of battle-weary men. So it showed that it was possible to have a homosexual novel with a happy ending. But his reputation was very, very high, and someone of his literary standing publishing a book on which even in 1960, when he finished it, would have been considered an incredibly controversial topic, and it would put a lot of people off. And one can see the reasons why he was fearful of publication, though he often said he was ashamed of funking it, as he put it.
I love the idea that it's the happiness that's the revolutionary, the really daring thing to show, that you're allowed to show the things ending in misery, and that's just about okay, but actually showing a happy relationship that works. Do you think that's why the goosing, the bum pinching, was so revelatory in a way? Because it's such a strong image, isn't it? Because it's very gentle, it said. It's like
it's
a little
joyful.
It's yes. Really joyful. Do you think that was because of the sort of ease and, the person who pinched him or patted him, he was just at ease. He was fine. Everything was all right. It was the happy ending.
I think so. And I'm forced to characteristically remarks. I understand he did it to a lot of people. So it wasn't so forced. It was
just did it to
case.
Everyone. Everyone got through the door, got a goose.
Not everyone went off and wrote a novel after it. But yes, I think as the whole idea of the happy ending, and I also think, I mean, the happy ending did cause all sorts of problems in a way that had it been a heterosexual relationship, it wouldn't be. The happy ending is what people expect from a novel about a relationship in heterosexual terms. And I think even in 1971, when it was published, I mean, some of the remarks of the critics about, this it's merely wish fulfillment and a fantasy. Well, to some extent, of course, it was, because he always said that, the trouble is this book can't be published until my death or England's. And even in 1971, one gets a sense from some of the critics that they just thought, oh, it's sentimental, which they wouldn't have said had it been, someone being carried off into the sunset, a man carrying a woman off into the sunset, or vice versa, indeed. And I think that the happy ending, it's why he wrote it, as he said, but it's what has led it to be underestimated, I think. I mean, it's not as though they don't go through a great many difficulties before the happy ending, but the logistics of the happy ending did cause him all sorts of difficulties. And Isherwood, Christopher Isherwood, was sort of instrumental in helping him in 1952 to start revising and putting in an extra chapter in which, after Alec attempts to blackmail Morris in the British Museum, there's a new chapter put in where they retire to a hotel for the night. And Isherwood put that in. And Isherwood was one of those people. He wrote to Gore Vidal when Gore Vidal published The City and the Pillar, which in its original version, it's about a gay man who finds his childhood love or his adolescent love and tries to seduce him. And in one version, he kills him. In the other version, he rapes him. And Isherwood castigated Vidal for saying, could we not have all these miserable endings, because it makes people think that this is what happens in homosexual life, and it isn't necessarily like that. There are lots of people who do form lasting and happy relationships.
It's so interesting, this matter of the ending, though, I think, especially because it's Forster, and so we think of that line in aspects of the novel where, you know, he wishes the novelist didn't have this need for a resolution, and he wishes that they could just stop when they get muddled or bored. He says, alas, he has to round things off, and usually the characters go dead while he's at work. And so we just have this sense now, because of what you've described, of these subsequent revisions where he's just really struggling with how to give us the happy ending at the same time as not letting it go limp, I suppose. And then things had to change in his own life before he could find his way to that, didn't they?
Yes, and right early on, I think, to Goldsworthy Lewis Dickinson, there's a series of very touching letters where he defends the happy ending and saying he'd got fed up with killing people off in his novels. And he said, you know, with just a little bit more luck, it could have happened. But of course, as you say, in 1930, he met Bob Buckingham, the policeman, who really became the centre of his emotional life thereafter. And Bob and his wife, May, they somehow accommodated this cuckoo in their nest. I remember when I was writing, I think, my biography of J.R. Ackley, I went to see May Buckingham. I also asked her about Isherwood, and I saw her several times. And I remember her saying, you know, oh dear, you're so forced. He couldn't even run a bath without letting it overflow. And if we went anywhere in the car, oh yes, I had to sit in the back. Old Morgan would be sitting up in the front next to Bob. I mean, she was remarkable, but it was Forster's own happy ending, really. And when he wrote the first draft of the book, he hadn't actually had sex with anyone. And it was when he was in Alexandria with the Red Cross and first of all had a casual encounter with a soldier on a beach, a sort of anonymous sexual encounter. He described it as parting from respectability, but then met this Egyptian tram driver with whom he had a sort of a very fulfilling sexual relationship. And he said afterwards, you know, I wish I'd known about this when I was first writing Morris. And there's no doubt at all that the relationship with Muhammad al-Adl, the tram conductor, certainly fed into the book in a sort of curious way. And he said, you know, I'm so lucky to have had this happiness. And he said, I sort of knew about it before, but not in this way. And I'm sure that's referring to the relationship he had at Cambridge with the man who Clive is based on. So in other words, he was saying, I had this sort of platonic relationship. So I sort of knew about love, but until I actually had a sexual relationship with someone, I didn't know how happy one could be. And that really is the crux of the novel, that the sexual relationship with Alec cures him of his feelings of guilt about being homosexual, cures him of his snobbery about class and all his sort of rather dreary opinions that Forster has great fun sending up in the course of the novel.
It does seem to be that class is really important in it, isn't it? Because he is sort of liberated from it, isn't he? He finds a liberation. The problem is with the people who seem to be sort of trapped in their ideas.
Yes, I mean, in Clive in particular. I mean, Forster said somewhere that, oh dear, he ended up by treating Clive quite badly because he got very fed up with him. The novel ends with Morris going to tell Clive what has happened with, because Alec was Clive's gamekeeper, that's how he met him. And he tells an appalled Clive what happens. And the novel ends with this wonderful image of Clive sort of shutting up the house and saying he's going off and wondering how to conceal the truth from his wife. So Forster not only has the happy ending, but he contrasts it with the obviously not terribly satisfactory relationship that his former lover has. Now he's become, as it were, heterosexual.
If this isn't too much of a digression, there's a suggestion, isn't there, that D.H. Lawrence was, let's say, inspired by the relationship with a gamekeeper.
Yes, that's right, because actually, unlikely as it may seem, when he'd written the first draft, he did show it to various people, most of whom were homosexual friends and colleagues. But he'd also just met D.H. Lawrence, with whom he had a very brief friendship that fell apart, largely because Lawrence couldn't really understand homosexuality. So it seems rather odd. And I don't think there's actually any proof, but it seems very likely that Lawrence did see Morris and then decided that he could have a gamekeeper too, having an affair with someone of a different class.
You would have thought he might just change the job so that it wasn't quite so obvious.
Yes, it is. It's very curious. I mean, someone has written a whole paper about the similarities between the two novels, which is fairly convincing. But frankly, I think Morris is a rather better novel than.
And of course, we all know how Lady Chatterley played out in the court. So concerns over Morris were probably very well founded.
I think one of the reviewers, in fact, pointed out similarities, said the differences that Morris is art and Lady Chatterley is balderdash or words to that effect. Perhaps there was something about gamekeepers. There's wonderful story, isn't there, about Lady Chatterley being reviewed in some sort of country magazine. And the review is entirely about how accurate it is on rearing pheasant chicks rather than anything else.
Okay, well, back to Morris then. So it remained unpublished until 1971. That was a year after Forster's death.
Yes.
So I suppose I have two questions. One, had he left specific instructions about its publication, i.e. that he did definitely want it to come out, but only once he was gone, or had he left it entirely in the hands of his executor? And two, how was it received?
What he did was, as I say, in 1960, he made the final corrections and he wrote the terminal note, as it's called, which is an appendix about how the book came about his hesitations about writing it, about his determination to have an happy ending, and actually about the Wolfenden report. He was very sort of concerned about the Wolfenden report, and that was being very much discussed in the press as he was doing his final revisions, because although the report came out in, was it 57 or 58, it didn't go into law till 67. So there was this long period where it was being discussed. But he definitely left instructions, and the terminal note is part of that. But he also gave Christopher Isherwood the rights in the book for American publication. So he'd actually drawn up a legal letter for it to be published in America and for Isherwood to have the rights, but to use them to set up a bursary, which would allow British writers who couldn't afford to go to America for research or whatever.
And in terms of its reception, well, I suppose it was mixed, but it was mostly quite negative.
It was. And you can see the problems, you know, that had the book, I mean, people kept saying how dated it was. And of course, you could say that of any of Forster's books, because they were all written, you know, before 1926. So by 1971, they might all have seemed dated. But the difference being that, of course, those books were published when they were written. So they had sort of, they were period pieces, whereas this was sprung upon the public very, very belatedly, and society had undergone enormous changes, not least homosexuality had been legalized or partially legalized by then, or partially decriminalized. And they would say reviews are mixed. When I was looking at them, I was pleased to see there were some that gave him credit, but most of them at the very least said, oh, it's not up to his usual standards. And Cyril Connolly actually was the one person who said, you know, this is a writer, a novelist at the height of his powers. But he did then go on to say, but it has fatally dated. But he did say, you know, it could, had it been published at the time, have taken its place between Howard's End and A Passage to India. But a lot of people like Frank Kermode thought it was very thin, and Noel Annan sort of agreed. There was a general agreement, it just didn't have the substance of the other novels. And I mean, people have said this is just sheer homophobia, and it was just, you know, people didn't like it because it was a gay novel. I think that certainly had a slight influence, but I think it was a sort of discomfort about the whole thing that you know, here was this great novelist who had written this novel that clearly did have elements of wish fulfillment in it. But I think 50 years on, we can see how good the novel is, and it's one I've read, I should think, four or five or more times, and it seems to me to get better every time I read it.
One of the criticisms, and you know, I expect this would have been the one that would have perhaps wounded Forster most, was about his attitude to his characters and to their love, and to the rightness of it, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, there were several critics who, it seems to me, just simply didn't understand the novel at all, because they complained that there wasn't, as it were, enough sex in it, that Forster didn't really sort of have sort of a full description of what Morris and Alec got up to in bed. But it was very much a novel of its period, and really, I don't think that the problem there was they extrapolated from this that Forster didn't really approve of homosexuality or indeed sex at all. And we know now from Forster's letters and diaries that indeed he did have a very fulfilling sex life and was often writing to the newspapers saying, you know, homosexuality should be decriminalised and it's ridiculous and the laws should be changed.
It seems an extraordinary accusation, really, for especially given that, as you say, he's writing his novels in the 1910s and 1920s. It seems a little bit short-sighted to say there's not enough sex in it. Why isn't there loads of sex? I'm sure they didn't say that about the other novels. They didn't say there's not enough sex between the men and the women, so he must not like it. I mean,
yes, well, I regret to say that the reviewer in the TLS said he didn't think much of the sex in the other novels either, and this was no better. But then he went on to say that Forster clearly found sex repulsive and sordid, and how he would have got that from reading the book.
Well, exactly.
Which, as Cyril Connolly said, is a lyrical book. The whole point is that it's the not having sex with Clive that makes the relationship a sort of impoverished relationship. And it is that whole thing where he does have sex and a fulfilling sexual relationship with Alec. But of course, he has to overcome a lot of his own prejudices. And there are lots of places in the book. It's where he goes to attempt a cure from a doctor, a GP who's a friend of the family, and says, "I'm an unspeakable of the Oscar Wilde sort." And I mean, Morris, in his own voice, talks about, you know, how he's been degraded by sex and this. But of course, eventually he overcomes all that and he overcomes all his other silly prejudices. And that's really the point of it.
The hypnotist, I think he's described as, isn't he, who would have this cure. Even he is given lines that sort of seem to suggest that to read the novel as being against true gay love is almost a willful misreading, because even he says things like, "England has always been disinclined to accept human nature," just a very, very
wonderful
straight
line,
and beautiful
that,
line.
Yes. I mean, he's quite a good character, and he does say, you know, "I don't succeed in, as it were, curing by hypnotism, curing homosexuality." But another thing about that is that Morris wants to be cured of his homosexuality. But once he's had sex with Alec, the hypnotism really just goes to pieces. He can't concentrate on anything.
Well, he's found his cure.
Yes, he's found the solution to his dilemma, should we put it like that?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, people were... the research I've been doing for this anthology of queer life in London between the war and decriminalisation. I mean, the amount of, even in the 50s and 60s, when Forster was revising the book, the number of leading psychiatrists, supposed experts in homosexuality who gave testimony to the Wolfenden Committee, the number of them who do talk about whether it's curable or not. And it was still believed all this time later that it was a condition that could be cured in some way. But of course, the point of the book is that Morris doesn't realise that he doesn't want to be cured because he's found the solution.
Mm. When did you first read it, Peter? Can you recall what you made of it that first time?
It came out in 1971. And I think I first read it when a very kind tutor at university said, "This is a book you should read." So I think that would have been in the early 70s. I remember thinking, some of the stuff that Connolly mentions about the ragging that goes on between Forster and Clive, and it all does sound sort of slightly archaic. And I mean, Isherwood was very interesting about it, because when he read it, Forster said, "You know, I'm very worried it's dated." Isherwood was reading it in the 30s. And I think very wisely, Isherwood said, "Why shouldn't it date?" But there were aspects when I read it that did seem faintly absurd. I mean, particularly as a sort of young undergraduate in London, sort of when gay liberation was in full flow. But I sort of loved it. And I always remember what I really loved was what he wrote about it in the afterword. And at the time, I'd probably not read too many of Forster's other works. I think, like a lot of people, when I first started research on the biography of Ackley, and I had to read lots and lots of Forster, and I had this idea of him as this sort of rather Edwardian maiden aunt figure, which has often been said rudely. And it's when I started reading his letters and his diaries, I realized that really he was much more modern than that, and much more relaxed and very, very funny. I think Isherwood's description of him as an anti-heroic hero is absolutely right. There was something heroic about him, even if he didn't publish this book. And there's something pretty heroic about writing a book you think will never be published, I think, and actually bothering to finish it. And I think it's nice that he has now been re-embraced by a lot of contemporary gay writers. That would really please him, I think. I think he'd be very touched.
And you touch on that a bit towards the end of your piece, this kind of this thing of him only recently, really relatively recently, recovering from what seems almost a great and unfortunate misunderstanding to be embraced by newer writers. So perhaps you could just take it away with some of those, just to end this lovely conversation.
Yes, well, I mean, for example, Damon Gulgut's Arctic Summer describes it. It's a novel which is very cleverly actually integrates real Forster with Gulgut's own prose. And actually, he does it so well that you can't, without checking, you can't tell where Forster ends and Gulgut begins. But it describes that period where he wasn't writing. And it's a very touching book. And I thought it was extremely good. And then, of course, there was the Matthew Lopez play Inheritance, this enormously long play in which a group of young contemporary Americans want to tell their stories. And Forster is this sort of figure who actually appears on stage as a sort of guiding light. And he is castigated for not publishing Morris in his lifetime. And he says, you know, it's the one thing I regret. But at the same time, the novel is the favourite novel of one of the main characters, who's the moral centre of the play, really. And then there's a boy who sells himself for sex and is sort of terribly damaged and young. And he reads the novel and he says it's as though Forster is reaching out across the centuries to him and saying, you know, I've been where you've been and I'll be there, I'll be with you. And I find that immensely moving. And I think Forster would also have been very touched by this.
Another kind of resolution.
Yes.
Well, Peter Parker, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, two histories of neighbourhoods in Britain cast light on neighbourly love and, well, probably hate in the early modern period. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Now, before we turn to early modern neighbours, Lucy, I've been desperate to ask you, I've been wondering about your allotment. Has it been battered beyond recognition by this mad, mad rain that we've been having?
It has, I'm afraid. Poor old thing is in a bit of a sorry state. And the things that are thriving the most, I hope I'm not the only gardener finding this, is the slugs and the snails. They're very, very happy.
I've noticed they've gone for it
in such a big way. I would put in young vegetable plants, and they basically would get their knives and forks out and sort of do up their napkins, and they'd be like, thanks very much. And the next time I come, there's nothing there. So
I can't really go out in the garden these days just because there are so many. It is a phobia of slugs because I get really dizzy when I see them.
Gosh, yeah, I would be just falling over the whole time if that happened. Yeah, yeah, I can imagine.
The frogs are loving it, though, so, you know.
We have got one frog. We surprised each other the other day, so I'm pinning my hopes on the one frog. So no pressure.
It's going to have to do a lot of eating.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, either way, I think it's safe to say that it's weather for staying indoors as much as possible. Luckily, the Boston Book Festival appears to have preempted that with its annual festival taking place between October 16th and 23rd.
Yes, and you don't have to be near Boston, do you? Because it's the hybrid thing again that we were talking about, isn't it? I think it's all online. Yeah, but there are also in-person events. So you could see all of it online if you wanted to, and it's free, which is great.
Always nice.
Yeah, and it's got a great big program, which has got 40 odd sessions. Pulitzer Prize winners Bob Woodward is going to be there. Is he a Pulitzer Prize winner? I think he probably is.
Yes.
Yes, there you go. National Book Award winners, poets, historians, storytellers, policymakers. I noticed a couple of things. There's Annette Gordon Reed is talking about slavery. She's written for us.
Juneteenth.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. And there's a brilliant thing that caught my eye, which is not the same sort of thing at all, but it's a session called Middle Grade. I don't know how old you are if you're in middle grade, so apologies for that. Middle Grade Graphic Novels, Cats versus Dogs. Just a very, very straightforward.
How about Frogs versus Slugs?
Well, that probably is less of a crowd pleaser, isn't it, really? And there's lots of, you know, so you can have Bob Woodward or Annette Gordon Reed or Cats versus Dogs or anything in between, I reckon.
I like the idea of anyone, any kind of the format of any panel is something versus something. So it's Bob Woodward versus Annette Gordon Reed, slugs versus frogs, anyone you can find versus someone else.
That is not the event.
That's not what's happening.
No, it's absolutely not. It's going to be much better than that.
Much better than that. And all the information on that is at bostonbookfest.org.
We're going to turn our attention now to something which has been part of society for the longest time. We've all got them, unless we're pretty wealthy or live very remotely, and we all have opinions about them, ranging from love to hate, I imagine, and we are them ourselves, crucially. Now, this all sounds a bit cryptic, but really, it's the most normal thing in the world, neighbours. And I will spare you the Australian soap theme tune, don't worry. This week, the historian Arnold Hunt has reviewed two books for us about early modern neighbours in the 16th and 17th centuries, and guess what? Some of this stuff might sound familiar. We're delighted that Arnold can join us all the way from Nashville, Tennessee, which sounds like a lovely place to be, sitting here in grey, rainy London. Arnold, thank you very much for talking to us.
It is a lovely place to be, and thank you for having me.
Not at all. Now, you start your fascinating piece by talking about the lockdowns, which is a very recent past, of course. How did you think that affected the idea of neighbourhood?
Well, we've all had the same experience, I think, haven't we, of having to work from home and being confined in our own houses a lot. And I think we've all felt both the good and the bad sides of that. But one thing it does mean is that you can't get away from your neighbours, for better or for worse.
Yeah, so there was a sense of, in the sense of, there's a sense of community with people coming together to help each other, but then also I think you said there's been also lots of extra complaints about noise and things like that. It's kind of amplified everything, do you think, about neighbours?
Yes, I don't know what your experience of working from home was during the lockdown last year. I suppose the big memory for me was Clap for Our Carers Thursday evenings at 8 o'clock, and we all emerged rather nervously onto our doorsteps, a bit like hobbits emerging from their burrows. And it became quite an occasion in the My Road, where I live in London. We would all wave to each other from a safe distance from our doorsteps, and somebody down the road would let off a rocket and we would all applaud. It was a very welcome moment of neighbourly togetherness in the middle of what could be a very isolating time. And yet there is the other side of neighbourhood, that one is trapped at home, and a lot of people were complaining that there they were in small flats with noise coming through the walls, no sense of privacy. So it was an experience of the best of neighbourhood and also the worst of neighbourhood.
Mm-hmm. It really makes you realise how much like a marriage it is, the whole thick and thin part of it.
Yes. And you also refer in your piece to an important social history from the year 2000, Bowling Alone, which documented Americans doing exactly that, going out bowling on their own, when perhaps, 30, 40 years previous to that, they might have gone out with neighbours or people who live nearby. But nostalgia about neighbourhoods not being as close as they used to be, that is in itself an age-old thing, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Putnam's book called Bowling Alone came out in 2000. And essentially he was arguing that there was what he called an erosion of social capital, less face-to-face interaction. We were less likely to hang out with our neighbours, less likely even to know our neighbours. And I guess that I can intuitively feel the force of that. As somebody who grew up on a suburban street in the 1970s, where perhaps there were 20 households on our street and we knew all of them. And now I'm living in a similar suburban street in London, and we know perhaps three or four of our neighbours. So when Putnam says we are less likely to know our neighbours than our parents or our grandparents were, that feels intuitively correct to me. And yet people have been complaining about this for a very long time. And the book I was reviewing by Andy Wood called Faith, Hope and Charity gives some marvellous examples of that from the 16th and 17th centuries. People complaining that neighbourhood was dead, that charity was growing cold. And he calls this the depressive mood music of the early modern period. So there's a sense in which neighbourhood has always been in decline. Neighbourhood isn't what it was, but then it never was.
Well, in a way, that's quite a cheering thing. If you think, well, if they thought that then, probably everyone thinks it all the time. So in this book, Faith, Hope and Charity, it says that you said that the neighbours were bound together in the early modern period by a lot of ritual and folk custom, weren't they? Which sounds idyllic, as you point out, but in fact is obviously that has a flip side as well.
Yes, perhaps I could talk a bit about the book itself, because it really is quite a remarkable book in some ways. It's published by an academic press. It has the trappings of an academic book, but it has a deep sense of passionate engagement with its subject, which, to be honest, you don't find in that many academic books these days. There's the famous saying by E.P. Thompson about wishing to rescue the people of the past from the enormous condescension of posterity. I feel this is a book very much in that tradition. It's trying to rescue people from the condescension of posterity and trying to give them their voices back. And he does that in a very powerful way, I think. I just want to quote the final few lines. He's writing about a story from 1612 about a young woman who's been thrown out of her mother's house in Norfolk for bearing an illegitimate child. And all we know about this is her mother's deposition. And her mother says that just as the sun was rising in the morning, she went out with her daughter Dorothy into the lane beside the house and got on the road, gave her blessing and went home. And what has become of said Dorothy and her child, she knoweth not. And that's all we have. And out of this, Wood just asks the question, how would this have felt for Dorothy? What would it have been like to have been thrown out of her mother's house, out of her community, out of her neighbourhood. And he ends with this sort of very powerful peroration. Can we ever know, he says, as Dorothy began her journey, she left her neighbourhood behind. Faith passed away. Charity was frozen cold. As Dorothy passed onto the road, bearing no more than her mother's blessing, she knew that for her, neighbourhood was truly dead. So I think you just get a sense from that, this is not your average academic textbook. This is a book which is deeply, passionately engaged with the lives of people in the past.
Mm, and it's imaginatively engaged, it sounds like. It's sympathetically imaginatively engaged.
Yes, very much. And speaking of somebody who has done their fair share of archival excavation, I can testify to what an achievement it is to bring the texts out of the archive and make them speak like that.
Mm-hmm. And so there were these, he talks about this, I mean, as you say, his vision of it is in a sense, it's a slightly pessimistic one, is it? Because he talks about Dorothy. I'm just thinking about what bound people together at that point. And you're saying it was ritual and folk, though that also had its downsides. And also religion was a huge part of the bond that held people together. But of course, people still judged others as to whether they felt they were being a good Christian or a bad Christian. That didn't mean everybody behaved well, of course, just because everybody was religious.
Well, yes, that's the fascinating thing about the book, I think. It does have this deeply pessimistic side, a deeply dark side, in showing just how tough life could be for the poor. And yet, if you look at the introduction, he says he sees the book as a celebration. Very surprising word to use. It's a celebration, he says, of how people held their community together in the face of terrible, difficult, and profound pressures. So it has those two sides to it. The dark pessimism of revealing the social cost of poverty, but also try and show how neighbourhood was a positive force that could hold communities together.
Thinking about the specific period, I mean, I know we've said that every period thinks it's witnessing the demise of neighbourliness, but were there also changes to the fabric of society in the early modern period in Britain that could have led to a weakening of the bonds? You know, in a similar way, I'm thinking to technological developments in our time and, you know, personal security systems or whatever, as well as religion. Were there changes in, I don't know, property law, for instance, that might have changed the way neighbours related to each other and personal space and so on?
Absolutely, yes. It's been argued for quite a long time that this was a period of profound social change. What seems to be happening is there is greater social division, particularly in village communities. The richer villages are getting richer, the poorer villages are getting poorer. So there is less sense of the community as an organic whole, and more sense of the social difference, the social gulf between the rich and the poor. And what also adds to that is the development of the poor law, the welfare system, which means that poverty starts to be regarded as a problem. And I think when wealthier people look at their poor neighbours, there's a sense in which they see them less as neighbours and more as a potential problem, a social problem, a cost to the welfare system.
Right. So it's that sense that they're a problem rather than, you know, we're a society, we're a community, and they are occupying a particular position in that community. It's almost as though they've been codified as a problem. Is that right?
Yes, yes. Some historians have talked about the invention of poverty in this period, which is not to say that there was no such thing as poverty before the early modern period, but it's in this period that poverty first starts to be regarded as a social problem, as something which has to be dealt with.
It's fascinating.
And the second book that you review, which is Caritas by Katie Barclay. So that looks at the Scottish kind of Puritan Presbyterian communities, which seemed very strict, were often run along very strict lines. But she argues, I think, does she, that they were bound together by love and charity, well, as the name of her book suggests.
Yes, indeed. This book is really a contribution to the emotions I mean, if the big question for Andy Wood, how to recapture the voices of the poor, I think the big question for Katie Barclay is how to recover the history of emotions, the history of feelings. And she's looking at, in this book at 17th and 18th century Scotland, where the archives are very good, better in some ways than for England, in fact. And her big idea is the idea of the loving community, as she puts it, that the idea that early modern Scotland is a society which is structured around the idea of neighbourly love as a means of social cohesion. And as you say, that's quite a surprising argument, because when we think of Scotland, we think of this strict and repressive Calvinist society. So to argue that it's a society founded on the values of love and neighbourly love is a fascinating claim.
And does she back it up? Does that, because it almost seems as though they're treating fairly similar subjects, aren't they, the books? But would you say Andy Woods is actually quite dark, and it's about what happens when you're cast out of your neighbourhood and there's nothing else to fall back on, whereas Katie Barclay's, it seems to be saying, well, look, in some of them there's a real sense of charity and the neighbourhood will hold you.
Yes, there's a fascinating discussion in the book of the idea of loneliness. People in the 18th century clearly had a concept of loneliness, but it's surprisingly difficult to find people who say themselves, I am lonely, I feel lonely. It's not an emotion that people seem to articulate in the way they do now. And she points out that Samuel Johnson's dictionary defines loneliness as a solitude, want of company. So it's the fact of being on your own. It's not an emotional state or form of longing. The reason for this, she suggests, could be simply that in a society with a stronger sense of neighbourly values, a stronger sense of social cohesion, there is less opportunity for people to feel lonely. People may be on the edges of community, but they are not separated from community completely.
And that even among the very poor, there was charity. They would help each other in as much as they could.
Indeed, yes.
And then in a way, in your piece, you come full circle, don't you? Because you say, in the end, the greatest threat to neighbourhood was not Puritanism, but pandemic. So what did the plague do to these communities?
Well, yes, it was quite an uncanny experience in some ways to read these books. They're both recently published, and I assume they must both have been written before the start of the pandemic. And yet in many ways, they seem to echo what we've just been going through. So Wood writes about plague and pandemic disease as an attack upon the idea of neighbourhood, the idea being that when plague strikes, people will shut their doors, close their doors to outsiders and even to their neighbours. And there's a fascinating quotation that he gives from a 16th century preacher talking about an outbreak of plague and how, as he puts it, gladsome salutations in meetings had been replaced by a diligent shunning of each other's presence for fear of infection. And reading that, a shiver went down my spine in a way. It was so recognisable. It could have been written yesterday.
Yeah. And so what that did was kind of, well, the same as it did for us, I suppose. It atomises everyone, puts them behind their own doors, as it were.
Yes, indeed. There is the famous story, a bit of a legend, really, but the famous legend of the village of Iam in Derbyshire, where the plague strikes in 1665, and the villagers make a collective decision to stay where they are, not to flee the plague, so that while they may catch the plague, they won't infect the rest of the countryside. So this is often held up as an example of heroic altruism and social cohesion. Reading Andy Wood's book, you also want to ask about the other side of that, which is, you know, what happens in the next village along? What happens in the neighbouring village when you hear there is plague in the neighbourhood? Well, obviously, you shut your doors. And when passing tramps or travellers or wayfarers come up, you know, asking for a bed for the night, you shut the door. So again, as constantly with Andy Wood's book, there were the two sides of neighbourhood. It was the positive side of pulling together, supporting each other. There is also the negative side of shutting people out.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of fascinating and, as you say, rather uncanny parallels there. Arnold Hunt, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Peter Parker and Arnold Hunt. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Molly Guinness. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.